Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. Monday couldn't come soon enough for Rudy Giuliani after a weekend of flubs and walkbacks. Even Stormy Daniels' lawyer couldn't believe what he was hearing.
It's an absolute unmitigated disaster for Rudy Giuliani and the president. It's a train wreck.
The White House says the trains are running just fine, thank you, with a new legal team and a new communication strategy. It's part of a big week ahead that could see a CIA confirmation battle, a decision on the Iran deal, perhaps a decision on whether or not the president will sit down with special counsel Robert Mueller and plead the fifth. This hour on Point, top political reporters open their notebooks to the week ahead in Washington. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of Rudy Giuliani's media blitz? Is he helping President Trump or hurting him? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. A terrific panel today of top Washington reporters is with us. Jeff Begay's Justice and Homeland Security correspondent for CBS News. His forthcoming book is called Kompromat, How Russia Undermined American Democracy. That'll be out in July. Jeff Begay's, welcome back.
Hi, Jane.
Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time Magazine. Molly, great to have you as always.
Thank you so much.
And Michael Warren, senior writer for this Weekly Standard. Michael, great to have you.
Hi, Jane.
So a media marathon this weekend. The president's new attorney, Rudy Giuliani, tried to clarify, if not clean up, a bit of a mess he created last week. Here he is speaking to Fox News on Saturday night. Giuliani talking about getting his facts straight.
The facts. I'm still learning. This is, 1.2 million documents. I've been in the case for 2 weeks, virtually one day in comparison to other people. So I'm not an expert on the facts yet. I'm getting there.
Jeff Begay, I'm new. I'm getting it right. I'm getting it straight. But Giuliani did raise new questions about whether the president paid hush money to other women. He suggested the president might invoke the Fifth Amendment to avoid testifying in the Russia probe. I mean, there's so much to get to here. Recap the weekend for us.
Well, as my daughter tells me, my 16-year-old, I can't right now, Dad. It's just there is so much going on with this communication strategy that it's hard to keep track of what happened, what they say happened, what didn't happen. So it's really been a confusing message from Rudy Giuliani. Of course, on Friday, the president said that Giuliani is still getting his facts straight, still getting up to speed, and that still seems to be the case. And all of this, of course, revolving around, this payment to Stormy Daniels of $130,000. Originally, Giuliani said that the president reimbursed Michael Cohen, his personal attorney, for that payment, which opened up a whole nother can of worms in terms of this potential investigation into whether campaign laws were violated. And over the weekend, of course, Giuliani did not clarify the message at all.
So here he is again, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani recently joined President Trump's legal team. Here he is on ABC's This Week telling host George Stephanopoulos that the president would not have to cooperate if special counsel Robert Mueller subpoenaed the president.
What happens if Robert Mueller subpoenas the president? Will you comply?
Well, we don't have to. He's the president of the United States. We can assert the same privileges as other presidents have.
Here's President Trump telling reporters he would love to sit down for an interview with the special counsel.
I would love to speak. I would love to. Nobody wants to speak more than me. In fact, against my lawyers, because most lawyers, they never speak on anything. I would love to speak because we've done nothing wrong. There was no collusion with the Russians. There was nothing. There was no obstruction.
And then after that, Rudy Giuliani, again on ABC, asked if he was confident the president would not invoke his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination if he spoke to the special counsel.
How could I ever be confident of that? When I'm facing a situation with the president and all the other lawyers are, in which every lawyer in America thinks he'd be a fool to testify, I've got a client who wants to testify.
Let's talk about the subpoena possibility, Molly Ball. Talk to us about that, about what the former mayor of New York, Rudy Giuliani, said about that. Could the president defy a subpoena to testify?
Well, it would certainly wind up in court either way, and it is unsettled in terms of the legal precedent whether or not he could be forced to testify. Previously, I believe, when Bill Clinton litigated this issue, and he did end up settling and agreeing to testify before the courts could conclusively determine that. And there's other precedent on it as well. I'm not a lawyer, so I think there's a lot of complications there. I think we should remember that hasn't happened yet. This is all very one-sided because we're only hearing from Trump's team. We haven't heard from Mueller. We haven't had any indication of what they, in fact, will ask for when they get to the point that they want the president to speak. There's obviously been negotiations behind the scenes. We have heard about those, again, mostly because of leaks from the president's side of this, not because of any official statements made by Mueller and his camp. So what is happening is you see, as Jeff was saying, Giuliani going out there and muddying the waters and dangling a lot of possibilities, raising a lot of hypotheticals. What we don't know is when push comes to shove what the actual answer is going to be, because there are so many conflicting statements and conflicting possibilities. So the whole upshot, I think, of this Rudy Giuliani press tour has been to just make this even more confusing. And because, you know, Trump's whole strategy has been to litigate this in the court of public opinion by confusing people and by polarizing the issue, bringing people who support him onto his side by framing it in political terms as a witch hunt, as something that's directed at him personally. So that it, I guess it advances that objective. It's hard for me to understand what other objective it advances.
So, Michael Warren, what about that? Do you agree? Is this part of the new communications strategy for the Trump team to sort of complicate and confuse and muddy the water? I mean, there are many people who are saying Rudy Giuliani not only exposed the president politically, but legally as well with this media tour.
No, I agree with Molly that this is less a legal strategy than it is a communications strategy. Yes, Rudy Giuliani is a lawyer, but I think that he was not hired for his litigation or legal skills. He was hired to do exactly what we've been seeing, which is to not just muddy the waters, but to, I think, put in people's minds, in the public's mind, seed or seeds of doubt about this investigation, and to make the point that look, the president and Trump and his lawyers are all doing what they can to cooperate, but that this is an investigation that has just gone so far beyond what it ought to have, that the Mueller team is really going out of bounds here. The Trump team is trying to cooperate, but this special counsel really has gone beyond its purview. You're seeing not only that message from the Trump team, but also it's being bolstered by what you're hearing from House Republicans, particularly the House Republican Intelligence Committee, which released a report over the weekend that's really pushing this idea that that the origin of all of this, the FISA warrant on Mike Flynn, the former National Security Advisor, was all achieved fraudulently or sort of incorrectly, inappropriately, and that this whole investigation is essentially has gone on too long and was corrupt from the beginning. That's the unified message here.
So Jeff Begay's, and there's real anger coming from conservatives and Trump supporters on that point, right? That the scope of the special counsel has gone well beyond Paul Manafort's bank fraud or financial dealings. It's really now about doing whatever it takes to bring down Donald Trump. And to that point, this federal judge in Virginia, sharply critical of the special counsel and the investigation. How does all that move forward this week?
Well, it certainly gave the president some talking points at the NRA gathering last Friday, and he used that and he got cheers from the crowd. This was the district judge, T.S. Ellis, who was appointed by Ronald Reagan, who said to the special counsel's office in court during a hearing on the Manafort case. Paul Manafort, of course, the former campaign chairman, he was in court on bank fraud charges, and he is arguing that Mueller's prosecutors have gone too far. And the judge, T.S. Ellis, said to the prosecutor, who was in the courtroom at the time, you don't really care about Mr. Manafort's bank fraud. He went on to say that prosecutors were interested in Manafort because of his potential to provide material that would lead to Trump's prosecution or impeachment. So the judge, in that case, basically is saying that the special counsel had exceeded his mandate. And eventually the judge is going to make a ruling on that. But it's obviously something that the president's supporters seized on.
Mm-hmm. And Molly Ball, Rudy Giuliani, you know, sort of spoke to that. He spoke to a lot of other things. But it makes me wonder, Giuliani was brought on board to speed up the Mueller investigation, to bring it to conclusion here. But I'm wondering, has he done just the opposite?
Well, nobody is in control of the pace of this investigation except Robert Mueller. And I think that when the president's attorneys in the past have repeatedly said that they expect it to come to a conclusion, that's either wishful thinking or they're trying to placate the president and stanch some of his frustration, because you do hear from the White House and from the president's legal team that it creates problems for them when the president gets annoyed and lashes out. So they try to calm him down by telling him, don't worry, you know, this will all be over soon. We're going to bring it to a close. They don't actually have any control over that. They have some control in that, you know, they're talking to the investigators, and they can offer things in a faster or slower pace, but they don't really have control over the course of the investigation. I would say, you know, to the idea that Rudy Giuliani is out there with a purposeful communication strategy, boy, if there is one, it is way over my head. I am maybe just not smart enough to see the incredible brilliance of having him go out and say all these things, but it doesn't seem very much like a strategy. There is a message, as Michael was saying, there is a message that more deliberate members of the team in the White House would like to get out there about the scope of the investigation and so forth. But Giuliani hasn't been on message. He hasn't been driving a consistent set of talking points. He's been all over the place.
We are looking at a big week ahead in Washington with a great panel. Jeff Begay of CBS News, Molly Ball of Time Magazine, and Michael Warren from the Weekly Standard. More after this break. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes life is exactly like the movies.
T-minus 30 seconds.
They said T-minus. They said T-minus.
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy and sometimes about rocket ships.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're looking ahead at a busy week in Washington this hour, and you can join the conversation. What do you make of a judge accusing Mueller of going too far in the Russia probe? What advice would you give the president on the Iran deal? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Great panel, the Weekly Standard senior writer Michael Warren, Time Magazine national political correspondent Molly Ball, and CBS News justice and homeland security correspondent Jeff Begay. Here's some more sound. Stormy Daniels attorney Michael Avenatti followed Rudy Giuliani on ABC's This Week on Sunday. He had strong reaction to the interview he had just heard.
Did that interview just happen? I mean, I'm not being spoofed, right?
You heard the whole thing. What's your reaction?
Well, it's an absolute unmitigated disaster for Rudy Giuliani and the president. It's a train wreck. I can't believe that actually just happened. I mean, what we witnessed by Rudy Giuliani may be one of the worst TV appearances by any attorney on behalf of a client in modern times.
Even Fox News hosts have been questioning the value of Rudy Giuliani's repeated media appearances. Here's Shepard Smith reacting to Giuliani's word salad and Laura Ingraham on Giuliani's admission that Trump repaid Michael Cohen the Stormy Daniels hush money.
Whether you prefer ranch or balsamic on Giuliani's words, President Trump denies that his own story has changed at all.
I love Rudy, but They better have an explanation for that. That's a problem.
So, Michael Warren, jump back in here. Stormy Daniels lawyer Michael Avenatti said that after Giuliani's media appearances, the chances of placing the president under oath are now stronger. Do you agree with that?
I don't know. I mean, we have to keep in mind that Avenatti is an interested party in this conversation, and I don't know if I really trust or buy what he says, or at least I take it with a grain of salt. I will say that, this does not make sense as a legal strategy, but I don't think that's what Rudy Giuliani was brought in to do. As we said earlier in the show, this is an effort, really, it looks to me, to discredit the Mueller investigation, but to discredit all of the legal problems surrounding Trump. And that includes the Michael Cohen situation. I don't think it helped, for instance, the Stormy Daniels side of things, for Stormy Daniels to appear on Saturday Night Live as she did on Saturday night. I thought that was probably not a smart move for her credibility. But I think that this is the effort that Giuliani has been brought in to shore up, which is a public relations campaign, not necessarily a legal strategy. As a legal strategy, maybe it probably doesn't make a lot of sense. But that would assume that the Trump legal team is sort of thinking in those terms, rather in terms that more comport with the way Trump usually and in the past 40 years of his public life has engaged on these issues, which is in the public eye and within the media rather than in the courtroom.
Here's the Saturday Night Live appearance you made reference to, Michael, this weekend by adult film star Stormy Daniels, appearing in the cold open with Alec Baldwin, who portrayed President Trump.
I solve North and South Korea. Why can't I solve us?
Sorry, Donald, it's too late for that. I know you don't believe in climate change, but a storm's a-coming, baby.
Jeff Begays, talk about this notion that the president could take the fifth, could plead the fifth in the special counsel investigation. Where does that stand?
Well, that is a strategy that obviously they are kicking around. But in terms of the political atmosphere, I'm not sure it would do the president much good to plead the fifth, especially given what he has said on the campaign trail in the past, that people who plead the fifth are guilty of something along those lines is what he said. So I'm not sure that is a legal strategy that would work with the Russia investigation. But it just speaks to the disarray. There is Giuliani out there making these statements, confusing this issue, and I'm just not sure that helps the president's stance with the special counsel. Obviously, there are these ongoing discussions about whether or not the president will sit down for an interview to be questioned by Robert Mueller. But this idea that you could take the fifth and somehow get out of it, I'm just not sure that is going to work. And if there is a subpoena, then that does not obviously work in the president's favor as well, because he will be sitting before a grand jury without his attorney. And of course, that would be a big problem for someone who, even his supporters acknowledge has a hard time staying on message. And so the legal strategy, the communication strategy that we've seen over the last several days, I'm just not sure it's effective in terms of this standoff with the special counsel's office.
Molly Ball, President Trump said he would, quote, love to testify. To Jeff Begay's point just there, is that a good idea?
Well, it depends whose side you're on. I mean, the president, we've heard repeatedly, the president said this multiple times, that he wants to testify. And that kind of fits with what we know of his personality and of his instincts. He likes to take things on frontally, handle them himself.
He says he's fighting back.
And he likes to fight. At the same time, it may also be a strategy, right? As Mike was saying, to appear to be cooperative, while as he also, the president sort of caveated that statement the other day, I'd love to talk to him, but it has to be fair. So, putting out the impression that it's not his lack of cooperation that's the problem. It's the process prosecutor's lack of fairness, if it comes to that, if it comes to a refusal. But we have also heard from sources inside the White House repeatedly over the course of the past, you know, year or so, as this possibility has been considered, that they do worry about the president's instincts and they do worry about the president's ability to be consistent and to tell the truth. The president has a history in his pre-presidential life, you know, giving depositions in which he said things that contradicted the facts multiple times. Mm-hmm. His lawyer's worry is partly about their client, partly about the possibility of a so-called perjury trap that clever prosecutors are very good at creating situations where a defendant can become sort of trapped in a web of untruths, if you will. That is what he's talking about is this idea that it might not be a good idea for him to do this. Again, this is going to come down to if it does come down to a subpoena, this is not up to the court of public opinion. This is up to a judge taking stock of the law. And it would probably, I have to think, go all the way to the Supreme Court. So it doesn't really matter what we think about it at that point. It's a matter of what the law says.
Let's get Matthew in here from Pierre, South Dakota. Hi, Matthew. I'm glad you called and thank you for waiting.
Yeah, no problem. How you doing?
Hi, good. Go ahead.
Yeah, so my opinion is that he has a right to plead the Fifth, and I really think he should exercise that right because, I mean, by not saying anything, I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean you did it or you did not do it. I mean, he might be guilty, he might not, but exercising his right to plead the Fifth, you know, it protects him, and if he's a very bombastic person, he could easily say something that's ridiculous and could incriminate himself. So, you know, like, I think we should just leave it up to the courts and probe and let them figure it out. You know?
Matthew, thank you. Let's go to Carl in Nashville. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Yeah, he may accidentally say the truth. Think about this for a second. The conversation we're having is about the president of the United States who cheated on his other wife with a porn star. This is the conversation that we're having here on Monday in the United States of America. No one should be surprised that he has a slush fund for his affairs. No one should be surprised of all the lies that come out of this administration. And what we will have to do one day is the evangelical hypocrites that still support him by 85%, they have to be held accountable for putting this degenerate in the White House. And I have no problems calling him that because this is what he is. And
Carl, thank you. I'm going to cut you off because I want to get John in here. We've got so many callers. I appreciate you calling, Carl. Here's John in Richmond. John, you're on the air.
Hello, Jane.
Hi.
I think this president is interested in protecting himself and that the White House is their primary role is to do just that. Now, that's a short-term objective. They're doing that above and beyond all the possible consequences, the midterm elections, foreign relations, what he might be doing to the actual office of the presidency. It's exhausting. When was the last time you heard anybody, including the president, say no comment? There seems to be no thought behind the actions. It's all spur of the moment, off the cuff. Mm-hmm. To me, this is a long-term, huge risk to the country.
John, thank you. Thank you very much. Michael Warren, I mean, we heard Carl make a mention of it, the sort of the back and forth, the credibility gap. This is true. No, this is not true. I mean, the Wall Street Journal editorial read, Trump should worry that Americans will stop believing anything he says. Trump supporters say, well, this is nothing new. Exhibit A, Bill Clinton. I mean, how do you see this talk of a credibility gap? And is there a problem when it comes to other issues like Iran, like North Korea?
Well, first of all, I think that there's a strategy here. We've been talking about strategy this whole hour. There's a strategy here at work, which is on behalf of Trump and the White House, which is to make this point that we already know about all of this stuff. Everybody knew who voted for him, that Donald Trump was a cad. You know, everybody knew these terrible things about his character. But the point is that, you know, he's getting it done, or, you know, he's achieving what we'd like, whether that's for evangelical conservatives, as Carl mentioned, the right judges on courts. But I think that there is obviously there is a credibility gap here. And we talk about that 85% of evangelicals, for instance, or I think it's something like 88% of Republicans mm-hmm. support Donald Trump. I really question, I think you can look into some of the polling data on this, of how hard that support is for the president. I think that the cumulative effect of all of this, whether it is the Stormy Daniels revelations or whether it is just the feeling that the other caller had of it never stops, it's ongoing, it goes on and on, has an effect on a lot of those voters. It makes them soft Trump voters. They want to support the president. They like what he's done on taxes. They're waiting and seeing on North Korea, but they're frustrated by the sort of personal aspects of him. And they sort of back up and reassert their support when they feel like Trump is being attacked. But I wonder if that soft support really falls away if something big happens, whether it is the midterm elections going in the Democrats' way, or God forbid something really terrible happening on a national security level, or the stock market bottoms out for whatever reason. Those kind of big moments, or something big from the Mueller investigation comes out that's damning to the president. I think you would see then a lot of people sort of really distance themselves, and we will be looking back and thinking it's amazing. The president even had that much support from Republicans, but that's a huge if.
Do you agree with that, Molly Ball?
Yeah, I think Mike makes a really good point, because you do often see this sort of facile analysis that, like, oh, you know, there's another controversy, but it doesn't matter because it doesn't affect his political standing. You know, his approval rating hasn't budged, or Trump supporters don't believe it, or whatever. I think all of this matters, first of all, because politics isn't everything. But second of all, because if you do travel around the country, as I do, and talk to voters and talk to Trump supporters, or even if you just look at the numbers in the polls where you see that the strong disapproval number for Trump keeps shrinking, even as his overall approval stays the same, because those people become somewhat approves, right, or mm-hmm. or more mm-hmm. ambivalent. And so that's what Republicans are really worried about with regard to the midterm election, is that those who dislike Trump and are opposed to him are extremely energized and passionate, and the strong disapprove level for Trump keeps going up and up, while even those who want to believe, want to like him, do support his agenda, do support him overall, are getting more and more discouraged, more and more frustrated with what they see as a lack of strategy, lack of intentionality, lack of effectiveness, and just these constant distractions. You hear it from Republican voters all the time. I wish he would stop tweeting, right? Or I wish he just wouldn't say all this stuff. I wish he could sort of calm down and mm-hmm. be quiet, be polite, be orderly. Republican voters overall, in my experience, are very well-mannered people, and it offends them that the president doesn't seem to have any manners. So I think that that's the important thing politically, is not that he does continue to have broad support within the Republican Party, but that his supporters are getting more and more discouraged.
Jeff Begays, wrap this up for us here. I mean, the mention of Trump's poll numbers have come up during this period when there's been so much talk about Russia, about Stormy Daniels. The president's approval ratings have been going up. I mean, Democrats have actually lost a little ground going into the midterms by many accounts. Do Americans care about this as much as the political class in Washington?
Well, it really depends on who you talk to. I've talked to people who, you know, it just seems like Americans have taken sides. They're rooting for one team over the other, and it doesn't matter what the other team does. You know, so I think many people in this country have just taken sides. Some have just tuned all of this out. But the danger for the president, in terms of his support among Republicans, is that, you know, this communication strategy, whatever they're calling it, could again bleed away supporters who are just tired of the distractions, of the scandals, and all this talk about Stormy Daniels. So that could be the danger here for the president, politically speaking. Maybe it is a strategy that will work to ward off any further intrusions, if you will, by the Mueller investigation and Stormy Daniels' attorney, Michael Avenatti. But long term, this could take a toll on the president's standing among Americans who are tired of all of the distractions.
Let's get one last call in here before the break. Anne in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Hi, Anne. Welcome to On Point.
Yes. Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, we Americans following along in this whole saga, the most important thing I think we've learned, because most of us have been too busy to pay attention to this stuff, is how the corrupt Russians with their oligarchs and their illegal money directed by Putin are playing such a major role around the world in corrupting all kinds of things, including many democracies. And for that judge to say that the money laundering done by Paul Manafort may not be within the scope of the Mueller investigation is just complete craziness. And I don't see enough pushback from, you know, the commentators that are in the know on that whole thing. I think it's really important that we lay out how important the Russian money is to everything that's going on, not just in the U.S., but around the world.
Anne, thank you. I do appreciate your call. We're going to switch gears when we come out of the break here. The Iran nuclear deal, North Korea, Gina Haspel at the CIA, the midterms, what's going on in West Virginia, Ohio, lots of other places. We'll get to that after the break. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're discussing the week ahead in Washington this hour, and you can join the conversation. What are you watching for in tomorrow's primaries? What do you make of John McCain speaking from the heart? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Great panel this hour. Molly Ball from Time Magazine, Michael Warren from The Weekly Standard, and CBS News Justice and Homeland Security correspondent Jeff Begays. Speaking of the CIA here for a moment, let's get to Gina Haspel, President Trump's nominee to become the next director of the CIA. She sought to withdraw her nomination on Friday after some White House officials worried that her role in the interrogation of terror suspects could prevent her confirmation by the Senate. Here is former CIA Director Michael Hayden on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday, telling host Margaret Brennan that Gina Haspel is a wonderful choice to head the agency.
With a president who does not always attach his decisions to the real world, to data, to evidence, Gina Haspel is the one woman I want in that room when everyone else will be going into North-South Autobahn and saying, "You're right, boss." Gina Haspel won't.
She'll be dedicated. Yes person.
Absolutely not.
Molly Ball, the president is tweeting about this morning. My highly respected nominee for CIA Director Gina Haspel has come under fire because she was too tough on terrorists. Think of that. In these dangerous times, we have the most qualified person, a woman, who Democrats want out because she was too tough on terror. Win Gina. Molly Ball, what about this? Are these issues from her past valid? And what about her nomination now?
Well, there's a lot we don't know because there's a lot in her past that has been undercover, that has been classified. There's a lot that has not been publicly aired. And that is what would probably come out during her confirmation hearing, is Democrats would be asking her for a lot of details. And I don't know how much she would be able to provide. I mean, we should make clear that when the president says too tough, her detractors would say it was torture. That's what she's accused of having participated in, was the torture of detainees. So, and that's obviously a very controversial thing, something that a lot of Democrats and some Republicans are very concerned about, and that would be an issue at her confirmation hearing. The hearing scheduled for Wednesday. The White House apparently talked her out of withdrawing her nomination on Friday, but it seems to have been a matter of her saying, look, if there's a question about whether I can be confirmed, and this is going to be a brutal hearing that puts me through the ringer and puts the CIA through the ringer, I'm willing to take it off the table, not go through with it. But it does seem now that the White House is committed to her nomination. It is still not a slam dunk for her to be confirmed, I think.
Michael Warren, how do you see this? Will Gina Haspel survive this? And can the administration pull together another successful nomination if she doesn't?
Well, I read this news that she tried to withdraw as a signal that she was not confident in the White House's ability to defend its nominee. Apparently, she was convinced otherwise by Saturday and decided not to withdraw. But it was sort of an inauspicious start to this very, very tough week that Gina Haspel is going to have. I think that if you go back a little bit into Haspel's history, she's a something like 33-year veteran of the agency, very well regarded within the agency, and as Michael Hayden said, he sort of bolstered that point. She was selected as Mike Pompeo's deputy. If we remember what happened at the beginning of the Trump administration, there was actually very bad blood between the intelligence community and President Trump. His transition had criticized the CIA after the CIA had essentially determined that the Russians did interfere with the election and had done so on behalf of Donald Trump. Mike Pompeo comes in as the Trump nominee and selects Haspel. And that was seen widely within the agency as a nod toward the agency that he was going to – that Pompeo would defend and the Trump administration would defend the CIA against all of its critics on the outside. So I think that sort of informs how we think about Haspel's – why so many people are supportive of her sort of within the intelligence community, but I think that that her willingness to withdraw suggests that the White House wasn't quite ready to defend her on those sort of things, and we can see back to the transition to see why that sort of a fraught relationship between Trump and the broader intelligence community.
Well, we'll be watching Gina Haspel this week. I want to move on to the midterm elections that are coming up here and fast, and Republican efforts to maintain or expand their party's majority, Senate majority, that begins in earnest this week with blockbuster races in West Virginia, also crucial races in Indiana, Ohio, North Carolina. I want to play this. West Virginia Republican Senate candidate Don Blankenship debuted an ad that many people found offensive and xenophobic. Here it is. This is from last week, where he attacks Mitch McConnell, uses derogatory terms for Asian Americans.
Swamp Captain Mitch McConnell has created millions of jobs for China people. While doing so, Mitch has gotten rich. In fact, his China family has given him tens of millions of dollars. Mitch's swamp people are now running false negative ads against me. They are also childishly calling me despicable and mentally ill. The war to drain the swamp and create jobs for West Virginia people has begun. I will beat Joe Manchin and ditch Cocaine Mitch for the sake of the kids.
Molly Ball, a lot in there. President Trump tweeting about this as well this morning. He says, to the great people of West Virginia, we have together a really great chance to keep making a big difference. Problem is, Don Blankenship currently running for the Senate cannot win the general election in your state. No way. Remember Alabama. How do you see this race in West Virginia and really beyond for the Republicans?
Well, it is giving a lot of Republicans flashbacks to Alabama, not in a good way, the Alabama race. And I think there's a couple interesting things about Trump's statement. I mean, Trump made the same argument in the course of the Alabama Senate primary when Roy Moore was one of the candidates, and Trump endorsed one of his opponents, not both, as he did in this case. That's the other interesting thing. The president did not pick one of the other two principal candidates in this primary versus Blankenship. And that's the real problem here, according to the strategists working on the race, this Republican primary, is that there are three candidates in the race. So Blankenship has the opportunity to win without a majority of the vote. What happened in Alabama was that Trump twice, because there were two rounds of the primary, endorsed the establishment's preferred candidate, Luther Strange, who was presumed to have the best chance in the general election. Republican-based voters didn't listen to the president. So that's one dynamic here is, do West Virginia Republican voters actually care what the president tweets? Because repeatedly we've seen in other primaries so far that they have not paid attention. The other thing that I find rather rich is that this is exactly the argument you heard every one of the, 205 other Republican candidates in 2016 use against Trump. They all said, you can't vote for this guy, you can't make him the nominee because he can't win a general election. And as the president never tires of reminding us, that didn't turn out to be true. So it will be very interesting to see what kind of mood the Republican voters of West Virginia are in, and whether, similar to the 2016 dynamic, actually, the two better credentialed candidates have simply bloodied each other to the point that a third less credentialed candidate can sneak into the general election.
Michael Warren, how do you view these crucial races in West Virginia and also in Ohio, North Carolina, Indiana, many of these places where President Trump won 2 years ago? Is he holding ground now?
Let me first take the West Virginia race real quickly. Mm-hmm. I noticed on Saturday one of the candidates, Patrick Morrissey, had an event planned for Sunday and said he was going to do a press conference and blast Don Blankenship, which was interesting because Blankenship had been in third place in several polls. He had released the ad that you played and had sort of been roundly laughed at. And then you had last week Donald Trump Jr. tweeted warning West Virginia voters not to vote for Blankenship. And then, of course, the president's own tweet this morning. Well, the Weekly Standard has two internal polls now that show Blankenship in the lead in West Virginia in that primary race. That is, I think, an indication of why Republicans have been freaking out the last 5 or 6 days. And it doesn't bode well for Republicans. I would say this. There's a big difference between what Donald Trump did in the 2016 primary and what Blankenship may do. If he does win the primary in West Virginia, he has to go up against Joe Manchin, much better general election candidate for the Democrats than Hillary Clinton was in the 2016 election, a much better fit for his state. I would be very surprised. We have not seen this in race after race where the Trumpy candidate, if you will, is able to really replicate in a general election that what Trump was able to do in the 2016 presidential election. The stakes are different. The personalities are different. Blankenship is somebody who was sent to jail. He was owned a coal mine that had a disaster mm-hmm. that killed dozens of people. I think that's going to be in a lot of Joe Manchin general election ads if he's running against Don Blankenship in the general election. And I wouldn't bet in that scenario on Blankenship, even if Trump and the rest of the Republicans end up begrudgingly getting behind him.
Mm. Let me go quickly now from these primaries to the Iran nuclear deal, because President Trump is staring down a deadline to decide on whether to keep that nuclear deal or to scrap it altogether. Molly Ball, when is the deadline and where is the White House on this today?
The deadline is Saturday, and the White House has repeatedly sent signals that it intends to withdraw. But there's a Groundhog Day aspect to this, because there have been repeated opportunities for the United States to withdraw from the nuclear deal since Trump took office. And instead, they have, in fact, recertified it, which has been puzzling to many who noticed that Trump said that this was something he was going to get rid of right away while he was campaigning. There's a lot of internal conflict within the administration over the Iran deal. There are several, at least, members of the administration, including, I believe, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, who believe it's worth staying in. We had a sort of procession of European leaders come through, all imploring the president to stay in the deal. So the governments of, you know, France and Germany and the UK, some of our staunchest allies, all asking the president to reconsider. On the other hand, there is a hawkish new national security advisor in the mix, John Bolton, who has been very outspoken in his private life before entering the administration about his disapproval of this deal. So I think there's a lot of moving parts. I don't think it's a done deal. I think the administration has sent a strong signal that it doesn't want to stay in. But again, we've repeatedly seen Trump walk up to the brink on this and on many other issues. He talks a big game, and then the action that he actually takes ends up being somewhat tempered. Mm.
U.S. oil prices, by the way, rose $70 a barrel for the first time since 2014 as traders braced for the president's decision. We'll keep watching that. I want to turn briefly to North Korea. More details emerging about a potential summit, Michael Warren, with North Korea. Talk about the latest on that. Is there troop withdrawal on the table? What about the release of those three Americans? Give us sort of the latest update and what to watch this week.
I think the administration has now officially walked back the withdrawal of American troops from the Korean Peninsula, although this was something that Jim Mattis, the defense secretary, had thrown out as a possibly still on the table. That drew a lot of alarm from national security conservatives and other observers of the peninsula. At this point, there is still a question about what's actually going to happen with these these detainees in North Korea. They were going to be released. I believe they were transferred to Pyongyang, away from their labor camp, but no news on that front. I think there's a big question about whether or not the president will give Kim the satisfaction of having met some of the president's demands in order to reach some kind of discussion. And I think that's what's worrying a lot of North Korea observers, which is this one-on-one talk of, A, where will it be? Will it be somewhere that will benefit the Kim regime? Or will the fact that it happens at all be enough to give Kim a moral victory, which is a big part of what he's seeking here? And will the president and will the United States give in too much in order to receive this sort of symbolic victory that doesn't actually make a difference in terms of the country's nuclear program?
Thank you for that. One last piece here. Senator John McCain, last week, he's battling brain cancer. He released an emotional excerpt of the audio version of his forthcoming book. It's called Restless Wave. He criticizes President Trump and opines on the current state of political discourse, and I want to play that.
Whether we think each other right or wrong in our views on the issues of the day, we owe each other our respect, as so long as our character merits respect, and as long as we share for all of our differences, for all the rancorous debates that enliven and sometimes demean our politics, a mutual devotion to the ideals our nation was conceived to uphold, that all are created equal, and liberty and equal justice are the natural rights of all.
Jeff, Molly, Michael, John McCain says his desire is to exclude President Trump from his funeral. He wants Mike Pence there instead. He wants former Presidents Barack Obama, George W. Bush to be eulogists. Striking comments from John McCain. Jeff, Molly, would you jump in?
Sure. I'm struck by the idea that those are striking comments at all. I mean, the idea that it would be a controversial statement, much less a sort of swipe at the president, who he doesn't name, just to say that people deserve respect and that we all ought to agree on our national ideal of equal justice. I mean, mm-hmm. He doesn't actually say that that's a criticism of Trump. And the fact that it's being read as such is really a remarkable sign of the times and sign of this president's reputation.
Jeff Begay, I'll give you the last word.
Well, yes. I mean, clearly the relationship between Senator McCain and President Trump has not been a good one. And even as Senator McCain has been in Arizona recovering, trying to get healthy, his family has noticed that the president at times has still been critical of him. And they've taken exception to that. And so some of what we're hearing now is this tension in that relationship coming out.
Well, a big week ahead, and we got to most of it with a great panel today. And I'm appreciative of Jeff Begay, CBS News Justice and Homeland Security correspondent. Great to have you, Jeff. Thanks.
Thanks, Jane.
Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time. Molly, thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
And Michael Warren, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. So glad to have you with us, Michael.
Appreciate it, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. For now, I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.